You know, one of the stunning attractions of this site here at Kentucky, I mean, one of the really stunning attractions is are the trees. I mean, really, when you go around these, so some of the variety, I mean, how on earth did they choose this site? I mean, how did they actually get the trees that they have here on this site? Because if you know, as you walk around the grounds, the trees that are around here are quite varied, and yet they're quite big. I mean, it's been here about 40 years. Most of these trees are more than 40 years old. So where they must have been naturally in the woodland as they cleared it and made it into a golf course, and they must have planned it incredibly well, actually going and determining what trees were there and what trees were available to leave them. But they really are stunning, and as far as the trees are concerned, and the trees next to the condos to give the condos shade, and I'm sure if you're a golfer as well, trees to bang your ball off and all that kind of thing. But I know that England was once known and renowned for trees. I mean, you Robin Hood? You see any pictures of Robin Hood and Sherwood Forest? And Mr. Gardner from the roundabout Sherwood Forest. You know, and you're looking at the entire country of England was covered with trees. And down in southwest of England, I mean, we're from South Wales, but on the other side of the Bristol Channel in southwest England, that area is totally covered with trees. Northern Scotland, all covered with trees. But you won't find trees there now. Trees there now, they've all been cut down. Do you know what they're cut down for? Henry VIII was one of the prime culprits. And what they used to do, actually, is that when an oak tree would be grown so far, so big, they'd chop the top of it off. So they'd branch out in a certain, you know, rounded way. And they'd do this. And you know why they do that? Because you can then get the solid part joined into the stem of the boat, the ship, the warship. And then you've got the ribs going on the sides of the warships. And these trees, and you go down these trees, the areas now, and there are no trees there at all. The trees are gone. And there were oak forests and ash forests and, you know, sycamore and beech and so on. All these forests that covered the areas like Dartmoor. Now, Dartmoor, they use for army training. And this last, if you go up there in wintertime, it's cold. And it's a howling gale because there's nothing but heather or grass, rough, really, really rough grassland. Do you know what heather is? Nobody knows what heather is. It's a little stubby. I know you do. Heather is a little stubby plant. It's about this tall it grows. That's about as much as it will grow. It's like wooden, woody, really. I don't know if you've got anything over here that's sagebrush land or sagebrush or something like this. Yes, sage. Yeah, I suppose the herb sage, when it gets old and tough and woody, that's like heather. And the sheep nibble it and keep it down, and they basically use it for sheep. But that's what it is. And the wind howls across the area, and they use it for sheep, and they use it for army training, so the army can go up there and train. And basically, you get people dying of exposure, walkers and climbers and so on that go on Dartmoor, and they get exposure in the cold weather. In the hot weather, and it happened this time, was it one or two people died this year, but basically they got exposed to the heat because there's no shade whatsoever. And in the cold it's exposure, in the heat you get heat stroke. And yet, you know, when you look at trees and what trees are, how God has made trees and how God's planted trees and so on in the past, trees are going to fit a great deal into the future. Trees are something that we need to take note of. Because when we're looking into the future, into the millennium, trees are something that is going to be used by God to create a utopia, physically a utopia. And the areas I want to go into today, I want to talk about trees and how they fit into the future. Because I thought it was an interesting topic. I had it in the back of my mind for about 6 months or so. And I want to talk about the end time problem, because the end time actually indicates there's going to be a problem with trees. There's going to be a problem with trees. And yet, God is going to take that end-time problem and convert it across into Eden. So I want to deal with this fact that it is conversion across to Eden. And also what happened in the Promised Land, because the Promised Land was unusual for the Israelites coming in, because they were coming from Egypt. They didn't have much in the way of trees. They had palm trees, but they had basically the Nile flooded, and the way things were watered in Palestine was very different. So I want to talk about the Promised Land. I want to talk about the regeneration that's going to be needed to take place. In other words, using trees for the right reason, because recapturing true value of trees. That's basically what I'm trying to talk about. I want to talk about the environment that will be produced in the millennium and when you come there. I want to talk about Solomon being a type of what will be coming and how he used trees and used the trees in the building of the temple. And finally, I want to talk about certain lessons that we'll learn from trees and God has actually built in, if you like, to trees. I'd also like to quote a little bit from this book here. It's called What Has Nature Ever Done for Us? Tony Juniper, he was the, I don't know, head honcho of Friends of the Earth, so it's a bit kind of biased. It's kind of tree-hugging in some ways. But he's got a few quite interesting quotations, which I think would be quite interesting to use. So the quotations I'll use, I'll be referring to that. Turn over to Psalm 96, first of all. So Psalm 96. And let's just have a look at a scripture here about the end time, a psalm about the end time. And I just want to quote a couple of verses at the end where it talks about in verse 12 of Psalm 96. It says, "Let the field be joyful and all that is therein. Then shall all the trees of the wood rejoice." So when are these trees of the wood going to be rejoicing? Well, it says, "Before the Eternal, because he comes, and he comes to judge the earth, and he'll judge the world with righteousness and the people with his truth." So it's focusing as a prophecy on the end time when Christ returns. And when Christ returns, it's saying, look, the trees are going to be joyful, and the field be joyful, and all that's in therein, and all the trees of the wood rejoice. Now, is that just a poetic language? Is that all it's talking about? Is it just simply using it as a poetry? Well, let's put another couple of scriptures together. Let's turn over to Isaiah 14, because it's talking about Babylon. And it's in talking about Babylon and what, not just the Babylon that was, but the Babylon that we're looking for right at this present time, exactly where it's going to come from. We know it's going to be European-based, it's going to be an extension of the Holy Roman Empire. But there's more to it than that. As Mr. Armstrong brings out, it's a system. It's a system that extends into our own governments. And this Babylonian system is going to be destroyed ultimately. But here in Isaiah 14, and it's interesting again, it's the chapter about Lucifer falling from heaven. But I want to concentrate on verse 4. It says, "Then you shall take up this proverb against the king of Babylon and say, how has the oppressor ceased and the golden city ceased?" And in that context, it says in verse 7, it says, "The whole earth is at rest and is quiet. They break forth into singing." So it's when Babylon is finally destroyed. And it goes on. It says, "Yes, the fir trees rejoice at you, and the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since you are laid down, no fellow has come up against us." So Babylon is going to use the natural resources. It's going to abuse the natural resources. And the abuse that will be there on the tree population is going to be quite extensive. And in fact, Christ himself will actually complete that. And if you find that, if you turn back a page or so to Isaiah 10, you find that completion that God himself, or Christ himself, is going to be involved in. Because here in verse 12 it says, "Wherefore it shall come to pass that when the Lord has performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem," in other words, when the church has been sorted out by the great tribulation, that's what he's really talking about, "I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks." He says, okay, eventually the Assyria itself is going to also suffer and be corrected. And in verse 18, it says, "And shall consume the glory of his forest." So it's talking actually about Christ's return. And as he returns and fights against Assyria, it says, "consume the glory of his forests and of his fruitful field, both soul and body." And whether it will be Christ actually doing this or Christ doing this through the invading northern tribes, because again, as the northern tribes come across, Russia and China, come sweeping in, They're going to remember the in Joel, the army that comes through, and what will happen. Everything before it is like the Garden of Eden. Everything's behind burnt and blackened. And here it says, both soul and body, and they shall be as when a standard bearer faints, and the rest of the trees of the forest shall be few, so few that a child may number them. Now, if you go into central Germany, the Black Forests, now in Germany, they are extensive, quite extensive. Of all the woodland in Europe, quite frankly, the Black Forest is pretty renowned. But it's saying here that those forests are going to go, they're going to be completely destroyed, to leave as few trees that a child can simply come down and actually number them and write them down. You know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9-year-old child can go and actually do a survey of how many trees they've got left in Assyria, in Germany. So it's going to be a time which is going to be quite difficult. And let's just remind ourselves again. Let's turn over to Acts 3. I wasn't going to turn there, but I think we will. Acts chapter 3. I just remind ourselves what it actually says here and make sure we get it right. Because in Acts 3 verse 19 it says, "Repent you therefore and be converted, that your sins may be blotted out, so that the times of refreshing shall come from the presence of the Lord. And he shall send Jesus Christ, which before was preached to you, whom the heavens must receive until the time of the restitution of all things." So things are going to be put back in place the way they were before. And that is true when you get looking at trees as well, and the use of trees and how trees are actually used, which God has spoken by the mouth of his holy prophets since the world began. We'll look at some of those holy prophets and we'll see what they've actually said since the world began. Now it's interesting, this guy, what's his name, Tony Juniper, he brings out one interesting point about trees. You know, you think, well, the Black Forest will get destroyed and all the trees are going to be burnt up. Well, okay, we'll lose a bit of woodland and that's the end of it. And that's all there is. But do you realize that probably the biggest creature, in fact, it is certainly the biggest creature, biggest living organism. Do you know what it is? You know, the blue whale? It's not a tree. No, it's not a tree. It's the fungus under the trees. The biggest living organism on Earth. They stretch for miles and miles. But they're very interesting. It says, "While much of the action appears to be going on above ground in the lush green plots," it's down below, and he's talking about lush green plots of forest gardens within forestry. "It's down below in the soil where perhaps the biggest difference is being made. Crucial to this are the mycorrhizal fungi." So these particular fungi that are actually in the soil. "These organisms help trees grow through the supply of nutrients, improve soil structure and control of disease. In return, the trees provide sugars." So it's a symbiotic relationship between the fungi and the trees. "The fact that they can devote up to a fifth of their entire output by feeding the soil fungi says something about the importance of this relationship between the trees and the soil organisms." It's an astounding figure, really, when you think of it. I mean, it's like ourselves. You think of the number of human cells in our bodies. Well, there are 10 times the number of bacterial cells in our bodies than there are human cells. Predominantly through the gut. There's 10 times the number of bacteria. And it's got a symbiotic relationship. You kill those bacteria off, you know, with antibiotics is one way you can do it. And you've got real major problems. You've got major problems. And if they were all killed off, you'd die. Because they're used in the digestive process. So it says here, with the trees also, with the microbial fungi, and there's this symbiotic relationship between the two of them. And it says, "The fact they can devote up to a fifth of their output, the output of sugars, in feeding the soil fungi, says something about the importance of the relationship between the trees and the soil organisms. Some 90% of the land plants depend on soil fungi to grow, so the relationship is vital." Now, what do you do with potatoes when you've got potato blight? Well, you spray them. What are you doing when you spray for potato blight? What's potato blight? Well, potato blight is a fungi. So what else gets killed when you spray for the fungal diseases? And again, we see this problem that we've got in agriculture generally. You've got these fungal diseases, and the fungal diseases being treated by chemicals. The chemicals then are treating not just the fungal disease, but also the underlying microbial or fungal symbiotic relationship between the plants and the fungi. And that relationship is quite remarkable. Let me read another bit here. So it says, it's clear. There were only, well, it says Martin Crawford is the trust director, and he says, I've been surprised how fast systems like forest gardens can become self-sustaining, he told me. It's clear that we are only just beginning to find out what mycorrhizal fungi can do. For example, it has just been discovered that plants can send messages to each other via the fungi to warn about pest attacks. It's a communication device underground between plants. They can literally, one plant over here gets attacked by a bug. It transmits into the fungi. The fungi, as I say, can be miles of, you know, several square miles in size. It's like a network. And the other plant over here will pick up the signal and therefore manufacture the appropriate chemicals to repulse the attack that's occurring. And so they start producing defense chemicals in their leaves before the pest arrives on them. I think there are more surprises like this to come. So I thought that was quite remarkable, really, just the relationship. And as I say, the end time problem, the lack of trees that are going to be there when we begin the millennium is going to be quite substantial. In Germany alone, it's going to be so that just a child can number them. It's going to be astounding because presumably it's the invading northern armies, but it might also be Christ himself will destroy, because he talks about, you know, rays coming from his sides, and but it is much more selective also. He also talks about that in Haggai. But let's turn over to Ezekiel 36. And here in Ezekiel 36, it gives the direction that will then be given to us to, you know, what are we doing? Where are we? How are we restoring things back to? What are we restoring back to? Well, here in Ezekiel 36, verse 33, it says, thus says the Lord Eternal, in that day I shall have cleansed you from all your iniquities. I'll also cause you to dwell in the cities, and the waste shall be builded. So you're looking at a time when the cities and the wastes shall be built in the, you know, different areas of the land, and the desolate land shall be tilled, whereas it lay desolate in the sight of all that passed by. So these desolate areas will be built, and they shall say, this land that is desolate has become like the Garden of Eden. So there's the direction. It's to bring something back to the Garden of Eden, the way the Garden of Eden was originally. And the waste and the desolate and ruined cities have become, better translated, clipped, and are inhabited, in other words, tended and looked after. Now, if we go back and just remind ourselves what Eden was like over in Genesis 2, again, notice the trees and notice the emphasis that is put on the trees. Now, he'd made the green grass and made all the living things and the trees obviously were part of that production in the days preceding. But when you're looking at Genesis 2, it specifies Eden itself, because it was in a garden specifically planted by God. And this is immediately after, as it says in verse 7, it says, and the Eternal God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being, living nephesh. And the Eternal God planted a garden. So this is Jesus Christ again. And he planted the garden. He's a gardener. Your Capability Brown had nothing on him. Really didn't. Capability Brown had to wait 80 years, well after his death, for his gardens to mature. And you'll go to places like Stourbridge and various other places in the UK where the rich landowners employed Capability Brown in the Victorian times to produce their gardens for them, and he made lakes and avenues of trees and so on. But only today do you see the real results. But Christ could simply say the word and he'd have an avenue of trees if he wanted to. So I say, Capability Brown had nothing on him. But the Eternal God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man who informed. So here is the environment that was intended. And out of the ground made the Eternal God to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. So again, as I said, somebody has taken some time and trouble here in Kentucky, and they've taken the time and trouble to make sure that the place is well equipped with trees, and well really equipped in a variety of trees that we find. Well, that's what Christ did. He said, made all the trees to grow, they're pleasant to the sight and good for food. And he planted them, and he commanded and they would have appeared, and he would have landscaped them. But also, within all of that, he had lessons to learn. And the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, the tree of the knowledge and good and evil. And a river went out to water it. So he had this, the entire garden was put together in around the trees. It was parkland. That's basically what it was. It was parkland. Now, the effect of parkland, the effect of trees, the effect of being outside, quite frankly, as Adam and Eve were, again, quoting from this book on what has nature ever done for us, it says that there's considerable evidence, too, showing how exposure to nature is associated with reduced stress and improved work performance. More specific studies have also demonstrated a link with lower blood pressure among dental patients, fewer reports of ill health among prisoners, increased self-discipline among inner-city girls, and reduced mortality among the elderly people. Children with attention deficit disorder have been found to show significant improvements if they play in natural areas or even have views of trees and grass outside their homes. So even just looking on trees, even just having a view, is sufficient to make a difference. One study found that even 10%, or for every 10% increase in our green space, communities can show a reduction in health complaints equivalent to a reduction in the average age of 5 years. So for every 10% increase in green space, you live an extra 5 years longer. The society lives an extra 5 years longer. So all of you living in woods, you're going to live till about 120. On top of the gains that individuals can get from nature, there is evidence pointing to social benefits. For example, community cohesion has been found to increase where there are more trees. In one study in the Chicago housing estate, people knew more of their neighbors when there were more trees than where they lived. In areas dominated by concrete, people interacted less. There's also less domestic violence in areas with more trees. Now, is that because people with better lifestyle and higher education can afford to live in more tree areas? Well, it doesn't say, obviously, it doesn't say. You can work it both ways round. But the fact that they would want to live in areas which have trees, it's much, much nicer, it's much more beneficial. And they've done the studies to be able to show that. Now, if you look at the Promised Land, let's turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 8. Deuteronomy chapter 8. Because the Promised Land is really, again, a type of coming out of Egypt and going into the kingdom of God. And they came out of Egypt and they went into the Promised Land. And the type of land it was different from Egypt. So if you're here in Deuteronomy chapter 8, and in verse 7, again, here is Christ speaking, telling them, he says, "For the Eternal your God brings you into a good land, a land of brooks of water." Now again, to attract water, if you fly over the Sahara, I've only flown over it going down. I've never actually gone across the Sahara lengthways, but that's about 4,000 miles. But going down over it to go down to Central Africa is 1,000 miles, 2 hours solid flying, and nothing underneath. You look over, the only thing you can see are the roads kind of scoured out in the desert of the big trucks that go in for the oil wells and so on. But the Sahara is barren completely. And in that, therefore, you then have the Egypt, which is part of that area. Well, it wasn't always like that in years gone by, but Egypt was a desert area even in years gone by. But then the overthrowing flowing of the Nile gave them the irrigation that they needed. It was very different from Palestine. "The Eternal your God brings you into good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and depths that spring out of valleys and hills, and the water is attracted by trees. The Judean wilderness, which I think I mentioned before, that area is barren desert now. And yet, years ago, you remember Absalom riding his horse and he went and got his hair caught in the branches? Well, that was in that area, the area that's known as the Judean wilderness today. It was the Judean wilderness then, but the wilderness was the kind of wilderness that you have in Colorado or somewhere like this today. In other words, it's trees. That was the wilderness. That was the wilderness that David fled into. But then they chopped all the trees down, and it's now barren desert, something like the Sahara. And Spain is going the same way as well, incidentally. But this, the land of brooks, of water, those trees were attracting water, attracting rain and depths, and spring out of valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley and vines and fig trees. Notice, fig trees, pomegranates, a land of oil, so olive oil, so you've got olive trees as well, and honey. When you've got honey, then you've got bees, and you've got pollination, you've got to have the flowers. If you've got the, you know, you've got to have the flowers, you've got to have a living, functional ecosystem that it would be there. So, very much different from Egypt. Turn over a few pages to Deuteronomy 20. Deuteronomy 20. You start to see, therefore, remember, Deuteronomy is written predominantly for them as they went into the land. So these are instructions as to how to operate within such a land that we just read about. But in Deuteronomy 20, verse 19, it says, "When you shall besiege a city a long time in making war against it to take it, you shall not destroy the trees thereof." Now here is God's thinking. You don't just go in there and wipe off every single tree. You conserve the trees by forcing an axe against them, for you may eat of them. And you shall not cut them down, for the tree of the field is a man's life, to employ them in the siege. Only the trees that you know, they're not trees for food, you shall destroy and cut them down. You shall build bulwarks against the city that makes war with you until it's subdued. So you've got to choose carefully, so you don't go ahead and cut the fruit trees down. Now if we find a few more laws, if we turn over a couple of pages to Deuteronomy 23, you see again how outgoing and giving in the areas of trees, in the areas of food, God is. In Isaiah, in Deuteronomy 23, in verse 24, it says, "When you come into your neighbor's vineyard, then you may eat grapes to your fill at your own pleasure, but you shall not put any in your vessel." Now, when we used to go scrumping apples, we always thought we were pinching them, which we were in English law. But in fact, that's not the case. As long as we didn't have a basket with us and we took them back with a basket. It says, "When you come into the standing corn of your neighbor, then you may pluck the ears with your hand, but you shall not move a sickle into your neighbor's standing corn." In other words, you have what you need there and then. You can live off the land, literally. And that is perfectly legal within the laws of God. And he's making these laws, and this is again, why are the fruit trees not cut down? Because people could go there and help themselves. They can help themselves. And with corn, you pick the ears off, and it doesn't say you can actually put it into a basket. But it is this giving way that is God's way. And it's interesting, talking about some trees in Kenya, this book that I've been reading says fruit and vegetables are the only beneficiaries of pest control duties carried out by birds. Because trees obviously have birds, they attract birds. And the birds, therefore, in fact, there was one particular case over in Bangladesh. This, again, can I just refer to this book? He noticed you go through these rice paddies, and in the middle of the rice paddy would be a stick, about 6 or 8 feet high, and just a branch, dead branch. And every single rice paddy would have this dead branch stuck in the middle of the rice paddy, and the rice paddy might be the size of this room, say. You have this dead branch in the middle. And what they did is it's a dead branch so that the birds could actually then perch on the dead branch and look at the rice paddy and therefore get a hold of the pests. And they actually cut down the pests by they stick a dead branch in, all the peasants, and the dead branch actually attracts the birds, they roost on the, or not roost, but they perch on the dead branch and they can then see the pests. and therefore they cut the pest significantly, and making the crop that much better. But he's talking about coffee, it says, was once routinely grown under tall forest trees. It says, when the effects of the birds were assessed upon the coffee yield by experimentally excluding them from certain areas with nets, so they actually netted certain areas away, they're found to be providing about $310 worth of value per hectare. So that's just purely, and I would imagine that the other birds from the other areas would be coming in anyway. So you can't have a complete accurate assessment. It says, the high in the hills of Kenya and Tanzania, Unilever owns extensive tea estates, and among the more remarkable characteristics of these places is the fact that they don't use any pesticides. The tea estates, make a mental note of that, my wife could make a mental note of that. Tanzanian and Kenyan tea from Unilever might be a good tea to buy. One possible reason why they've been able to get away with this is because the areas of natural forests and other habitats that have been protected and nurtured since the plantations were set up in the 1920s. Now, I'd imagine, and certainly Kenya, it was earlier than the 1920s. And at that time, there was a man called Albert Howard. And he was in India, in Lahore, in India. And Albert Howard was knighted by Queen Victoria, so he became Sir Albert Howard. And do you know what he was for? He was composting. Composting. And until the nitrogen fertilizer industry really hit the decks running, composting was the best way of getting nitrogen into the soil. Now, and he also improved the health of the animals in Lahore, and the health to such a degree that his animals, his cows, would rub noses with other infected animals with foot and mouth disease on the other side of the fence and not get the disease. Again, because of the land management that he had. And he was recognized as by Queen Victoria. And you know what then happened? Well, what then happened was along came World War One, and World War One, with the munitions, nitroglycerin being a particular new ingredient for those munitions, they then had the chemical, after World War One, they had the chemical works all in action. And what are you doing with them? They're making nitrogen explosives. We make nitrogen fertilizers. And therefore the entire composting and all the rest of it was swept to one side. But here, it was around that time that these were set up. And the forest kept the atmosphere moister and provided wood for drying the tea leaves. Richard Fairbairn works for Unilever, and he spent many years in East Africa and knows the tea business there very well. And he said that the trees have been retained on the estates for good practical reasons, to conserve soil and help stop fertilizers getting into the rivers. And on both of these counts, the protection of the forest has been a very successful strategy. The trees also help ensure that the rivers continue to flow in drought periods and act as corridors that allow wildlife to move freely around the estates, including many kinds of birds. And this in turn might be why there's been so few problems with pest infections. So again, you start getting trees in an area, and let me just get a drink of water if I may. You start getting trees in an area, and you start attracting birds into that area, and it therefore actually changes the entire ecosystem. And in the world tomorrow, it's going to be, you remember the flight movie that we saw? And how he expressed the symmetry and the design and the beauty, and he said he applauded just the entire creative genius that is there. Well, again, what would a forest be without birds? I mean, okay, we've got turkeys over here, but generally, I mean, the small birds, they make a forest, they make a woodland, productive and so on. In Deuteronomy 24, just the next chapter, it says in verse 20, when you have beaten your olive trees, you shall not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, for the widow. Again, the management of trees and the way in which trees were not just for the people who owned them, It wasn't a kind of company thing. And again, the land itself was owned by the families, but the land was owned by the families, but the families therefore had to be generous. It talks about going and getting a sheaf in the field, the preceding verse, or gathering the grapes in the vineyard. You don't go over it again. You don't do the gleaning. The gleaning is done by the gleaners who come in from outside, and they can go ahead and help themselves. And another rule that was here, if you turn back to Leviticus 19, so here is, when we look at the promised land, we see how trees were actually used by God to teach people lessons. They're used by God to teach people lessons in giving and having a giving nature, of planting that little bit more so that the people could come along and help themselves. And it was a giving society in that sense, the way God set it up. Now, whether it was, it remains to be seen. But it was certainly a giving society that God set up. But here in Leviticus 19, verse 23, we find another rule regarding fruit trees now. And this is a rule that we should try and implement ourselves as well when we're planting trees, even now. It says, "And when you shall come into the land where you've planted all manner of trees for food, you shall then count the fruit thereof as uncircumcised. For 3 years it shall be uncircumcised to you. It shall not be eaten." So you get a tree and you plant it for 3 years, the first 3 years of its planting. Now, it's in a container and planted already by the time you buy it. So you need to take that into account as well. But for the first 3 years, you leave the fruit fall onto the ground. In the fourth year, all the fruit thereof shall be holy to praise the Eternal. So it's used as an offering, and whether it's used to, you know, when at the feast and that kind of thing. "And in the fifth year shall you eat the fruit thereof, that it may yield to you the increase thereof, for I am the Eternal your God." So the fifth year you start to actually eat the fruit itself. So there's a 5-year rule. So it's a long-term project. I mean, what do they have today? Well, you plant trees, and then you grub them out in 10 years. And then you plant another batch. Well, you obviously lost your profit. It's telling you that no, trees are a long-term project. It's a 20, 30, what, 40 years, something like that. That kind of level. It's not just the quick turnaround, quick buck system that is extent. And again, how does that actually work? Well, again, when you're looking at birds, here's another note that he made regarding birds and tits. These are great tits in England. It says, "Even dedicated bird watchers rarely think of birds as essential economic actors. In many instances, however, this is exactly what they are. In addition to pollination services, waste disposal and disease control, some of those pretty birds are among the many creatures that undertake economically vital jobs as pest controllers." He talks about how he's watching and just basic observation of some birds in his garden. He said, "Assuming that the adult bird works for only half the time, that's still 8 hours, or 480 minutes per day." They were going backwards and forwards. There were two of them, backwards and forwards with the grubs. "At a rate of about one feed a minute, that means nearly 500 insect grubs were taken to the nest each day." These are tits now. I think they're great tits. Do you have tits over here? Yeah, okay. I mean, we have blue tits around our house, but and a few great tits, but I don't see them so much in the garden. But it says that 500 insect grubs were taken to the nest each day. The chicks were fed in the nest for about 20 days, and so it seems reasonable to estimate that some 10,000 caterpillars. So in addition to wasps, I encourage the blue tits and great tits in the garden as well. "Estimated that some 10,000 caterpillars and other food items were caught and eaten. More were consumed as the parents continued to feed the chicks outside the nest, and added to that is, of course, the consumption of the adults themselves." So again, everything is in balance. In the creation, eventually the creation is not going to hurt and destroy. So the balance will be slightly different in the millennium. Will this still be the case? Will it still need the predators the birds? How it'll work, we don't know, but you can guarantee this is the way it works at the moment, and it's the intricacy, it's the interdependence, it's the symbiotic relationships that you have within the natural world, and certainly trees play a huge part within that. and a huge part to teach us very many lessons. Now, when we look at the regeneration or the recapture true values of trees, turn over to Isaiah 41. In Isaiah 41, it says in verse 17, when the poor and needy need water and there's none, and their tongues fail for thirst, I, the Eternal, will hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. So here's what Christ is going to do, and he's going to do it using you and using me. I will open rivers in high places and fountains in the midst of the valleys. Now, remember when he came into the promised land? What kind of place was it like? Well, it wasn't like Egypt. It was a place with rivers and fountains and springs coming out of the side of the mountains. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. Now, if you get water within the wilderness of the Judean wilderness today, which is going to be the case because the water coming out of the Temple Mount will go right through that area, completely through that area, irrigating that area before it goes down to the Dead Sea. What do you have? Well, it'll go back to the kind of thing it was when Absalom had his hair caught in the tree branches. The same kind of thing. I'll make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. And then, notice, I will plant in the wilderness the cedar, the acacia, the myrtle tree, the oil tree. I'll set in the desert the fir tree and the pine and the box tree together. And the question mark about the word pine here, it could well be the oak tree. And so, again, the great variety, what he's saying basically is the variety of trees that he's going to be planting. It is Christ himself who will be planting these things in the wilderness areas. That they may see and know and consider and understand together that the hand of the Eternal has done this and the Holy One of Israel has created it. So we see, again, a lesson to be learned by the environment changing into the parkland of Eden. And across the world, you're looking at the parkland of Eden being made. It's interesting, poetically, turn over a couple of pages to chapter 44, something I noticed when I was preparing this, and I think poetically it makes an interesting point. Here in Isaiah 44, verse 16, it says, "He burns part thereof in the fire, and part thereof he eats flesh." He's talking about somebody who makes an idol. So he burns part in the fire, part he eats flesh, he roasts a roast and he's satisfied, he warms himself and he says, I'm warm, I've seen the fire, and the residue thereof, he makes the god and even he graves an image and he falls down and worships it. And, you know, how daft can you get? That's basically what God is saying here. And prays to it and says, deliver me for you are my God. And then had they not known, nor understood, he shut their eyes that they cannot see, and their hearts that they can't understand, and none even considers in his heart, neither is there knowledge or understanding to say, look, I've burnt part of it in the fire, yes, I've baked bread upon the coals, I've roasted flesh, I've eaten it, and shall I make the residue an abomination and fall down to a stock of a tree? I mean, it's crazy, totally insane. He's using a tree in a way which is absolutely insane. It's coming from an insane mind. Coming from an insane spirit. And it goes on, it says, he feeds on ashes. A deceived heart has turned him aside. The deceived heart is Satan. A deceived heart has turned him aside, that he cannot deliver his soul, nor say, is there not a lie in my right hand? In other words, what I'm doing, isn't it absolutely crazy? Isn't it totally insane? Remember these, O Jacob and Israel, for you are my servant, I formed you out of my servant, O Israel, you shall not be forgotten before me. And down in verse 23, sing, O heavens, for the Eternal has done it. Shout, you lower parts of the earth, break forth into singing, you mountains, O forests, and every tree thereof, for the Eternal has redeemed Jacob and glorified himself in Israel. And why the trees specifically? What are the trees rejoicing for? Well, in verse 26, it says, that confirms the words of his servant, and performs the counsel of his messengers, and says to Jerusalem, you shall be inhabited, and to the cities of Judah, you shall be built. What are you going to be built with? With timber. And I will raise up the decayed places thereof. So why are the trees shouting? Because instead of being used for such an insane and idiotic purpose as being made into an idol and being bowed down to, they're going to be used productively and become used as building materials, which is what they were designed for originally, and therefore, poetically, as I say, the trees themselves will rejoice, because the entire land will rejoice, because the whole thing is moving in a direction which is righteous, which is the right way it needs to go. And if we turn over a couple of pages to chapter 55, we again see this regeneration, this recapturing true values in the area of trees. And again, it talks, come unto the waters, you that have no money, come and buy and eat and buy wine and milk. In other words, here is the very Spirit of God and the action of God's Spirit. And within the action of God's Spirit, it talks in verse 8, it says, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor my ways your ways, says the Eternal. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways. So even in this area of trees, we need to be aware that what God has actually got planned, what Christ has got planned, is astounding. It's going to astound us at that particular time. For as the rain comes down, the snow from heaven, and returns not where there again, but waters the earth and makes it bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes out of my mouth. When God speaks, something happens. So when God speaks, something takes place. It'll not return to me void, it'll accomplish what I please, it'll be prospering in the thing that I send it. For you shall go out with joy and be led forth with peace. The mountains and the hills will break forth before you into singing, and all the trees of the field will clap their hands. Again, poetic language, but poetic language involving the trees. And the fact that the trees will rejoice, they're going to be used for the right reason. Instead of the thorn will come up the fir tree. Instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle. And it shall be for the Eternal, for a name, an everlasting sign that shall not be cut off. It's the Eternal that's going to be doing it, and actually causing it to happen. It'll be God will be planting. And how will he be planting it? Well, let's turn over to Ezekiel. Ezekiel 47. But in Ezekiel 47, he gives a clue as to how the planting will actually take place. And here in Ezekiel 47, as I mentioned to you, the waters will be coming out of Jerusalem and will be pouring then down through the Mount of Olives. The Mount of Olives will be split in two, and presumably there'll be a rift, valley of some description in the Judean wilderness as well, because it'll be a riverbed that'll flow down there and then into the Judean wilderness and right the way down to the destination of the Jordan and into the Dead Sea. And that's the water course for these waters, which are a symbol of the very Spirit of God that will come out of the throne area of Jerusalem. But here in Ezekiel 47, notice it says in I won't read about the miry places and so on, but in verse 12 it says, and notice it's by the river, upon the banks thereof. So on either bank of this river that is going down from the throne area of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem, it appears, will be actually be elevated, whether it be elevated even more, but certainly there'll be a plain area around it, and it'll be elevation of Jerusalem itself. But in verse 12 it says, and the river upon the banks thereof, on this side and on that side, shall grow all manner of trees for food. So these are food trees that are going to be growing on that side, but there'll be more than that, whose leaf shall not fade, neither shall the fruit thereof be consumed, be presumably consumed by pests or whatever. It shall bring forth new fruit according to its months, and because the waters they issue out of the sanctuary, and the fruit thereof shall be for food, and the leaf thereof, and it says for medicine. The Hebrew is the word for repair, and there is a speculation whether you put that together with the scripture that we read earlier about Germany, about Assyria, and there's so few trees that a child can write them. You're looking at the repair of the nations. Actually, cuttings will be used. And it's interesting that when we're looking at the trees today in the UK, I don't know whether did you have Dutch elm disease over here? Did Dutch elm hit? Do you have any elms left at all? Any elms? You still have elms, because we don't have any. I mean, they're gone. The nearest to an elm we've got is our kitchen table. And our kitchen table is made out of elm because elm was very cheap, and we can get great big thick lumps of wood out of the trunk, and make the kitchen table out of it. And you can see the beetle boring marks on the side of the kitchen table because we left it kind of rough on the either side. And you can see the course of the beetles, the Dutch elm disease. But, you know, elm's gone. We've got ash dieback. You have ash trees over here? Yeah, okay. Ash dieback has hit the UK. It's, again, thanks to, I think it was Holland, wasn't it? the source of that, or Denmark, one of the two. But it came over and it started, the ash trees are now dying. And the oak trees have got another problem with them. And, you know, so many of these trees, and you wonder whether in fact it's the atmospheric pollution that's causing the problem, or it's the fertilizer that's there. Again, is it the fungal? The fungal being, fungi being killed off. But it's causing problems. It's causing some major problems. And it's, the indication is that this kind of thing is going to continue. So there's going to be, have to be a regeneration that will take place. And the regeneration is going to be started over in that area, the Judean wilderness, in the area where this water runs down through the Judean wilderness, going down to the Dead Sea. So the regeneration, the recapturing of true values, and just imagine as far as the being used to build, because that's what trees are for. You're looking at 1,000 years that you're actually making your plans for. I know that the towers have the, you actually got walnut in your land that you've sawn down and allowed to season and now been used in the house and in the new building that you made. And that's very, very rare. I mean, I always imagine the, when you're looking at the millennium, of being able to actually plant walnut trees and see them being harvested, you know, 200 years later. Because the walnuts take a long time to grow. You plant something like an ash tree, I mean, it's a weed. It goes like, it grows so fast, it's difficult to keep on top of it, frankly. But a walnut is something different again. And yet, the quality, again, what are we going to be doing? It's going to be going back to Eden, as far as parkland is concerned. It's going to go back to the quality that's needed for the homes. And guaranteed you'll be planting walnuts. I mean, I've seen the walnuts here, down here, but the English walnuts are slightly different, a little bit different from that. Okay, turn back to Isaiah 35, and let's just have a look at the environment that it'll be producing. Isaiah 35. And here we find the passage. In verse 1 it says, "The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, for the desert shall rejoice and blossom as a rose." So that area of the Sahara, now they've started in the southern areas, they've started to try and encourage the trees, and as they encourage the trees to come back, so the birds come back in, so the wildlife starts to re-establish itself, and the whole, it attracts moisture. It was actually Charles Darwin. There was an island that he stopped at as he went down to go down to you know, the place where the finches and all the Galapagos Islands. But there was another one off the coast of Africa that he actually stopped at, and he was instrumental in getting them to plant trees. And 100 years later, the trees have fully grown, and you now can see the island because it's got cloud over it. You can see it from miles and miles away, and it's actually brought rainfall back onto that island again, whereas it was desert before. And the establishment of trees brings rainfall. Again, you notice in North Africa, Leptis Magna is an archaeological place in Libya, which, again, my brother was down in Libya. I went and visited him back in the late 60s. And visited Leptis Magna there. And now that was a grain port for the Roman Empire. They had a lighthouse, and all these things, the buildings are all, not intact, but they're all laid out. It's very similar to Pompeii, very preserved, it's been preserved by sand. And the buildings are there, and this was a grain port, because the entire North African area was grain. It was used as grain and imported then across to the Mediterranean Sea into the Italy. So much of that area was in fact grassland at one time, and you still see the pictures that certain people have drawn of the areas with rhinoceros and other non-desert species that are there. But it says, the wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the deserts shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. So we'll have to bring those deserts back to life. And it'll blossom abundantly and rejoice even with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it. Now Lebanon is the area of trees, mountainous trees. The glory of Lebanon, the excellency of Carmel and Sharon. Now those are plain regions, or the area of Sharon was a plain region. So you see grassland. And they shall see the glory of the Eternal and the excellency of our God. So again, the environment is going to change and change markedly, part of which you're looking at trees being used to do so. Now if you turn over to chapter 60 of Isaiah, in Isaiah 60, it's not just Israel that's going to change, it's going to have to be the rest of the world as well. And in Isaiah 60 verse 11, it says, therefore your gates shall be open continually, they shall not be shut day or night, that the men may bring to you the force of the Gentiles, the nations round about, and that their kings may be brought. For a nation and kingdom will not serve you, shall perish, yet those nations shall be utterly wasted. So we're looking at these nations bringing their wares and their goods in to Jerusalem and to Zion, to the church, to you and to I. Notice what he says. It says, the glory of Lebanon shall come unto you. Now, Lebanon is the place where they used to have the trees, where they had the cedars of Lebanon. And the cedars of Lebanon, that's where they came from. The fir tree, the pine tree, the box together, to beautify the place of my sanctuary, and I'll make the place of my feet glorious. So Jerusalem is going to be built in a stunning way, architecturally a stunning way. And a large part and degree of that is going to be the wood that's going to be used. Now the wood is going to have to come from timber. And wood's going to come from timber. the timber's going to have to come from wood. But it's going to have to come from trees. And therefore you're going to have trees growing and being planted. And again, the cuttings are going to be shipped out to the other nations. They're going to have to be planted. They're going to have to be grown. And the parkland is going to have to be made. Again, going back to Eden. Having the Eden-like quality to it, which is a parkland quality. And the gardens and the homes and the farms and so on will be in amongst that parkland. This is the indication that you find within the scripture. And the indication when you look at wood and the use of wood and wood use of timber, it's certainly something that we should take notice of. Turn over to Ezekiel 34. Ezekiel 34. I know one thing this book brings out was the floods in Pickering. Pickering is in Yorkshire, in the UK. And it has been, recently we've had very, very heavy rain. I mean, incredibly heavy rain, tropical type rain. And you have that in the hill areas, and all the hill areas, therefore, gullies come together. And then you have these raging floods that flood into certain areas. Pickering was one such area. And the flood defences that they're now putting in place, they're basically filling in the gullies, so that the drainage ditches that they cut in the hillside before for the hill farmers, they're filling in those so that they then dissipate out into the floodplains that were there or that still are there to actually take the floodplains. But they also plant trees. They plant trees in the path of the floods to then slow the flood down. They're also planting trees around the mango areas. Again, tsunami problems. The mangrove areas will withstand the tsunami waves and dissipate the tsunami waves in those kind of areas. So there's a certain wisdom that God had in putting trees where he puts them. But here in Ezekiel 34, again looking at the environment, you're looking at verse 23, I will set them up one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them, even my servant David, he shall feed them and he shall be their shepherd. And I, the Eternal, will be their God, and be my servant David a prince among them. And for the I, the Eternal, has spoken it. And I will make with them a covenant of peace. And I'll cause the evil beasts to cease out of the land, and they shall dwell safely in the wilderness, and they'll sleep in the woods. You know, go and camp in the kids, go and camp in the woods, no problem. I was talking to, I think, Mr. Steve Upton about the, when he shoots a deer, many times he won't go down and get them. And unless he's got a pickup truck and he can actually drive down to the deer to pick the deer up, he'll leave the deer there because of the snakes. Because, you know, you're wandering through areas. I remember following once somebody who went and showed me their small farm in Nigeria. And in showing their small farm in Nigeria, I thought, what is he waving his stick in front of him all the time? And suddenly realized why he was waving the stick in front of him as he walked through this long grass. And I was a little bit more careful where I put my feet. but you can see in the wilderness and sleep in the woods. My wife and I were walking, actually. We'd come back from somewhere down. We had an anointing to do, and came back and walked up through the woodland in the dark. And we had to go down to the security place to pick up a parcel. And so we walked down there. It was dark, with a torch. And we were coming back, and Mrs. Patient Bull was driving through. It says, by the way, just so you're aware, last year when we were here, I saw a bobcat running around this area. I thought, well, I don't think bobcats are dangerous unless they're cornered. And I checked that out, and apparently they're not dangerous unless they're cornered or rabid. But, cougars and bears are another thing. Anyway, but you can go ahead and sleep in the wood quite, let the little kids go and sleep in the woods. I mean, we have done that, but you're always apprehensive. You'd have to be into teenage, really, to sleep in the woods. And verse 26, and I'll make them round about my hill a blessing. I'll cause the showers to come down in season, and there shall be showers of blessing. And the tree of the field shall yield her fruit, and the earth shall yield her increase. And they shall be safe in their land, and shall know that I, the Eternal, when I have broken the bands of their yoke, and delivered them out of the hand of those that serve themselves of them. And it says, and they shall no more be a prey of the heathen, neither shall the beasts of the land devour them, but they shall dwell safely, and none shall make them afraid. And I will raise up for them a plant of renown. This does seem to be a particular plant, and it almost appears as if this thing is like a large shrub or a small tree. A plant of renown, and they shall no more consumed with hunger in the land, neither shall bear the shame of the heathen any more. So what is it? I don't know. No idea what it is, but it may be something that Jesus Christ actually brings with him, and that might be a large part of the cuttings that are being generated. And could it be they have a tuber? I mean, you have the yams over in Nigeria, and they have to be, they have long sticks, you know, as tall as this room, long sticks on a tripod, and they encourage the yam to grow up like a runner bean. You know what a runner bean is like a runner bean going up this yam tripod. But the yam itself is underground, but it's got to have the height to be able to grow. And then you get these yams, you know, really huge ones, three foot long quite easily, with great big round things, and you see them in the market there. But could it be something like that, and it also being the leaf being used, and perhaps even the bark being used, or perhaps even a fruit in addition? But whatever it is, it's something where they'll hunger no more in the land. It'll be a plant of renown. It could even actually mean a garden of renown. So it might be a multitude of plants. But it's something that certainly we look forward to at that particular time. Right. Now, a type of that end time, not end time, but the millennial rule, is Solomon. And if we turn over to First Chronicles, towards the end of 1 Chronicles, 1 Chronicles 22, we find how David actually made preparation for the temple. Because remember, it talks about my place of my feet will be glorious, and it talks about the timber that's being used for the place of his feet. But here in chapter 22 of 1 Chronicles, it says in verse 4, it says, also cedar trees in abundance. And the Zidonians and they of Tyre brought much cedar wood to David. So they were in the area of the cedars of Lebanon, the area of Lebanon. And so David actually put together a great deal of preparation for the temple. And we can see that if you turn over to 2 Chronicles now, 2 Chronicles, you now come into the time of Solomon itself, and that time is the type of the millennial rule. And when you're looking at 2 Chronicles 1, it talks about Solomon's rule, and right in the middle of there, in verse 15, and the king made silver and gold as Jerusalem, as plenteous as stone, cedar trees as the sycamore trees that avail for abundance. Now, we cut a sycamore down in our land late spring, early summer. It was an area which it was on the side of the road. It was leaning over a little bit, and I thought, really, we'll have it down. I actually got somebody else in to cut the thing down, because you know the trunk was about three foot across anyway. And there's not much apart from wood turning or burning. There's not much you can do with sycamore that I know of. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but maybe some carpenter can tell me other uses of sycamore. But when you're looking at cedar, I mean, cedar is really, really strong. And also, cedar itself it's got self-preservative in it. You make a wardrobe of cedar or drawers of cedar, and you don't need to put mothballs in there, as I understand, because the natural sap that comes out is actually keeps insects away. So cedars are something which are highly prized, and yet they were the same as sycamores as far as Solomon's time was concerned. And in chapter 2, if you turn over the page, chapter 2 verse 8, it says, "Send me also cedar trees, fir trees, algum trees out of Lebanon, for I know that your servants can skill to cut timber in Lebanon, and behold, my servants shall be with your servants." So this is Solomon talking to Hiram, king of Tyre. And when you're looking over in chapter 3, notice verse 5, it says, "In the greater house he'd sealed with fir trees, which he'd overlaid with fine gold, and set thereof palm trees and chains." So again, he beautified the house. He was preparing for the temple, the building of the temple, and it was a beautiful, beautiful building. And a large part of that was the trees, involved the trees. So if we're looking to make a utopia, and a large part of it is likely to be the trees. Let's turn over to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Because again, Ecclesiastes, read at this time of year, written by Solomon. Note that he wasn't just using the timber. Elsewhere you'll find that he actually studied timber. He was able to comment on everything, that from the hyssop that grew out of the wall to the cedar itself, and comment on the growing of timber, and the preserving and the use of timber. But here in Ecclesiastes 2 verse 4 it says, "I made great works, I builded me houses, I planted vineyards." So he actually was involved in the building trade a great deal, and the building trade uses timber. And for that reason, he says, "I made me gardens and orchards. I planted trees of them, all kinds of fruits." So within the gardens and orchards, he made trees. "And I made pools of water to water wherewith the wood that brings forth trees." So again, he was involved. And this is a type of the millennium, this time of Israel is a type of the millennium. God uses and teaches lessons a great deal through the use of trees. We turn over to Job chapter 14, and with so many trees around at that time, you can guarantee that we will be able to teach lessons to people in the same way as God taught Job lessons with the trees that he could see, even though he was in Egypt presumably. But here in Job chapter 14 it says, "Man that is born of a woman is of a few days and full of trouble." In other words, looking at lifespan, looking at our lives and what our lives are like, and how frail man is when contrasted to a tree. So he comes forth like a flower, and he's cut down, and he flees also as a shadow, and it continues not. You know, man, he can get a disease, he can be laid low, I could be dead tonight. I could be dead tonight. Literally, that's as much. I could be cut down, and short of a resurrection, I would not live again. I don't kind of lie down. It's not like the computer game. You're dead. Okay, you've got 15 lives. Okay, I'll get my next life back. It doesn't work that way around in real life. It just doesn't, because when you're dead all over. They used to say about Rover. But notice in verse 7, it says, "For there is hope in a tree, if it's cut down, that it'll sprout again. And the tender branch thereof will not cease." I mentioned to you, we walk down to the shop, most days in Samoidi. And they've cut down hedge, well, it wasn't hedgerow, it was a hedge that had got out of control. And some of the trees in the hedge were 20 foot tall, quite easily. And they cut those down in the spring, and now they've got shoots 2-3 feet long on them. Again, ash trees. There's many of them ash trees. But they're 2 or 3 feet long, quite easily, on the stumps that are there. "There's hope in a tree that is cut down and will sprout again, that the tender branch thereof will not cease. Though the root thereof wax old in the earth, and the stock thereof die in the ground, yet though they be sent in water, it'll bud and bring forth boughs like a plant." And there's a rose of Sharon, and you put it in water. We had one time at the feast over in, I don't think, was it over here? No, I don't think he was. I don't think Mr. Henderson would get it through security somehow. But he brought a rose of Sharon and put it down in the front of the lectern and put some water on it. And it's a dry, shriveled up, wizened piece of, like sage, like sage again, like heather. And it's all wizened up. But you put a bit of water on it, it just simply opens up and unfurls and then starts to grow. Just a little. I mean, you'd have thought the thing was dead, but it's not. There's life in there still. "There's a scent of water on it, and it'll bud and bring forth boughs like a plant. But man dies and wastes away. Yes, man gives up the spirit, and where is he? As the water fails from the sea, and the flood decays, so dries up, so man lies down and rises not. Till the heavens no more, they shall not wake nor be raised out of their sleep." Naturally, you can wait until the heavens freeze over, and nothing will happen. You can't make it sprout again. A tree you can. But you look at some of these oaks in England, anyway. Well, some of these bristlecone pines, and pines over in California. They've been thousands of years old, and the life of the tree. I know I bought a tree for a wedding anniversary one time. Or was it my wife bought it for me? I bought it for you, didn't I? No, the other way around. Okay, you bought it for me. Okay, fine. I bought the cherry tree. There we go. I bought the cherry tree. So yeah, I got thumbs up for that one. But there's a copper beech tree. A little tiny, see the tree, how big it's grown and all this. Do you remember that song? I'm not going to start singing it. But they got this little tiny tree, copper beech tree, and planted it in the garden, and it grew to about this high. I thought that's going to have to be replanted again, so I dug it up and replanted it right away over in the far corner of the garden. And it must be 20, 30 feet now, at all, quite easily. And it's spreading out and keeping the trim, the trunk trimmed of side branches, and I'm planning to put a seat underneath it. Now, whether it'll survive the tribulation into the millennium, I have no idea, but the trunk's about this size round now. So there's life in the tree. But a man lies down, he doesn't rise. Till the heavens are no more, they'll not wake. They'll be raised out of his sleep. Naturally, man goes and is dead. When you look at Mr. Armstrong's teaching, turn over to Revelation 22. When you think of Mr. Armstrong's teaching, it's the two trees was constant. Continually he was mentioning the two trees, the way of life. One is a tree of life, the other is a tree of death. One is a tree of the knowledge of good and evil you take to yourself. The other one is the knowledge of good and evil that God specifies. One is a way of give, the other is a way of get. And these two ways of life were typified within those two trees. And here we find in chapter 22, yes, it's symbolic language, and the symbolism is being used. It just is used as symbolism within Genesis. It's a symbolic language used there. But there's almost definitely, Almost definitely. It says, I remember Mr. Armstrong being asked the question, you know, was it a literal tree in the garden? He says, well, it says there's a tree, so I suppose there was. But he says, that's not the point. The point is the lesson that you learn out of it. And then he went on, he was on the two trees then, and he was on his way. But here, is it going to be a literal tree? A literal spirit tree that is going to be there? I wonder. I mean, God made the tree. Christ made the tree. He designed this structure. But it says here in chapter 22, and he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of God and of the Lamb. And remember, when we're looking at the millennium, we're looking at this river of life physically coming out of the sanctuary. Well, here is it in again. It's a spirit river to do with the actual spirit of God. In the midst of the street of it, now the bed of it would be better, the river bed of it, the bed of the river. On either side of the river there was the tree of the life, tree of life which bare 12 manner of fruits and yielded a fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. So even out, and this is well after all the physical is burned up, it's well after the New Jerusalem has come down, and you see this again, trees. Trees bearing fruit. Is it purely symbolic? It doesn't look as if it's purely symbolic. There seems to be an aspect there. Now, what's a spirit tree like? I've no idea. How do you eat from a spirit tree? I understand how you eat from the tree of life, the Holy Spirit. Now, you get on your knees and you go before God and you ask for the fruit of His Spirit. But is there something literal there? Again, we'll find out when we're born again. And we know as much about this tree now as we knew about those trees when we were in the womb. And I'm afraid I can't give you much more information on that score. But I want to show you this final scripture, Isaiah 51. Isaiah 51. This is the one where we have on the front of the website. And it's interesting, just having read what a vital role the trees play or will play in the millennium, and having read that there'll be the tree of life on either side of this river of life that flows after the New Jerusalem. When it says here in verse 16 of Isaiah 51, and I've put my words in your mouth and I've covered you with the shadow of my hand, God has got a hand in our lives. He's, you know, put His words in our mouth. He's put His thoughts in our brains and got through to us, lifted the veil and allowed us to see things that the rest of the world simply cannot see. And the reason why He's done that, He's covered them with the shadow of my hand, that I may plant the heavens. Now, we've always taken that, and I've always taken that, is, you know, get some stars around and move these stars around, move the planets around and so on. Okay, but then what? Well, the chances are you're going to be planting trees. Chances are you're going to be making Edens. Your chances are you're going to be making parklands. Are there angelic worlds out there that we don't know about? You know, why do you have 100,000 million stars in this galaxy? And this galaxy is one of 100,000 million. Why? Plant the heavens? We've got a big future ahead of us. And it looks like trees are going to be part of it. It looks like trees are going to be part of it. But certainly they're going to play a vital role in the millennium and possibly right out to eternity as well. Well, delightful to see everybody. We'll be at the dance tonight, all being well, God willing. We'll see some of you there. But let us say goodbye now rather than we might not say goodbye to everybody. I'd like to say goodbye to everybody now from the lectern. And it's delightful to have been here. It's gone too soon, but really good to see you all again. So keep safe till next year, and next year Jerusalem, or near Jerusalem. Let's put it that way.